if you put two hockey players on the ice, right? And they have the exact same top speed, the exact same shot mechanics, the exact same stick handling skills, one of them might score 40 goals and the other might, be out of the league in a year.
Yeah, it happens all the time.
Right. And when we watch a highlight reel, we inevitably point to the screen and admire the visible magic, the angle-breaking toe drag or, the puck placed perfectly under the crossbar. We look at that and say, like, wow, look at those hands. That is pure skill.
Right. We assume the skill is the differentiator.
Exactly. Which is honestly the absolute definition of looking at the wrong thing. So, welcome to today's deep dive. We are unpacking a concept that fundamentally redefines how we understand sports, strategy, and really high-stakes decision-making.
It really does. It changes everything about how you watch the game.
Yeah, so we are taking a masterclass today on a framework drawn from an extensive coaching and strategy guide. It's titled Time and Space Learning to Play the Game. And our mission here is not just to rattle off a list of tactics or summarize the rules.
No, definitely not.
Right. We want to build a permanent mental model for you, the listener, so you can deeply understand, explain, and actually apply these concepts.
And the foundational thesis of this entire model, it requires a massive paradigm shift. We basically have to invert how we think about talent.
Okay, lay it on us.
The core principle is this: skill is not what makes players good. Skill is what you spend. Time and space are what you earn.
I love that. I really love looking at this through the lens of personal finance, like your edge work, your snapshot, your ability to stick handle in a phone booth. That's the cash in your wallet.
Exactly. Cash is useless if you can't buy anything.
Right. But time and space, that is your actual bank account. If your bank account is empty, it literally does not matter how much potential spending power you hold in your hands. You have nothing to spend it on.
You are bankrupt before the play even
I start
started.
banked up before you even crossed the blue line.
And that perfectly explains our two hypothetical players from the intro. The producing player, they receive the puck with like a meter and a half of clean ice. Their head is already up.
Because they bought that space.
Right. While the struggling player receives the exact same pass, but with a defender's stick buried in their hip, right? And zero environmental awareness. They have the identical mechanical toolkit, the identical skill level.
The one player had the currency to execute their skill.
Yeah, and the other was instantly foreclosed upon.
So, to master how to actually earn this currency, we first have to unlearn a deeply ingrained misconception about what the word time actually means in a chaotic environment.
Oh, this is the biggest trap for beginners.
Right, because when beginners hear a teammate yell from the bench, "You've got time," they instantly picture a literal clock, right, like ticking down in their head. They think of seconds.
And picturing a ticking clock will just get you absolutely crushed on the ice. Time is not a measure of
So
seconds.
what is it?
Time is an equation. It's the physical distance to the nearest threatening defender divided by the speed they're closing on you.
Okay, distance divided by closing speed.
Yes, both halves of that equation matter, but the closing speed is the dominant variable, and it's the one that, well, almost everyone miscalculates.
Okay, let's run a scenario to prove how dangerous that miscalculation can be. So imagine you are retrieving a puck, you scan up ice, and a defender is 20 feet away. Human nature immediately kicks in, right?
20 feet feels huge.
Yeah, 20 feet feels like a massive cushion. You feel completely safe.
But it is a devastating trap. Distance without the context of velocity is a meaningless metric.
Meaningless.
Completely. Think about it. If that defenseman is skating backwards at you, maintaining a flawless tight gap, perfectly balanced on their inside edges, and their stick blade is already occupying your passing lane, I mean, they might be 20 feet away, but they're closing at a relative velocity of, say, 15 feet per second.
Oh, wow. So you do the math on the equation.
Right. You have roughly 1 second of actual time. And furthermore, if you're receiving that puck on your backhand, a fraction of that single second is already spoken for just by, rotating your wrists into a shooting or passing posture.
So you thought 20 feet meant you had this comfortable margin of error, but in reality, you had basically no time at all.
Exactly. Now let's flip that into a counterintuitive inverse scenario. Let's say a forechecker comes flying into your zone at maximum velocity, but they take a bad angle and they overskate you.
Okay.
Suddenly, they're physically only 3 feet away from your body.
And 3 feet sounds claustrophobic, sounds terrifying.
It does. But apply the equation. If they have overskated you, their kinetic energy is carrying them in a wrong direction. Their closing speed relative to you is zero.
Wait, really?
Actually, it is negative. Before that forechecker can physically impact your play, they have to violently hit the brakes, rotate their hips, and rebuild their acceleration from a dead stop.
Oh, I see.
In the physics of hockey, that mechanical process takes 3 or 4 tenths of a second minimum. So despite being 3 feet away, your time budget is essentially infinite.
Which brings us directly to the tactical application of negative closing speed, right? The reverse play.
Yes, the reverse is beautiful when executed correctly.
Because every amateur player in the world, when they feel a body 3 feet away, they panic. They default to a hard rim around the boards.
And against a heavy forecheck, a rim is just a death sentence.
Hmm.
It plays right into the direction the defensive structure is already flowing.
So the elite player reads that closing speed, recognizes it is negative, and stays entirely calm. Instead of forcing the puck forward into the pressure, they execute the reverse.
Right. They bank the puck backwards, strictly against the grain of the play, targeting the exact pocket of ice the forechecker just vacated.
You're literally weaponizing the forechecker's own momentum against them.
Exactly. By the time they arrest their forward progress, the puck is 20 feet behind them, being collected by your defensive partner.
But a reverse has distinct physical requirements, right? You can't just lightly tap it. A soft, sweeping backhand reverse dies in the corner.
Oh, yeah. If it dies in the corner, that instantly turns into a grade A scoring chance for the opposition. A successful reverse must be violently firm, kept low to the ice, and usually banked off the wall to bypass the forechecker's trailing stick.
Makes sense.
Additionally, because you're passing the puck into a blind spot below your own goal line, this play relies entirely on auditory cues. Your defensive partner has to vocally command the reverse.
So if they don't call it, you don't throw it.
100%.
Okay, so we've established that closing speed dictates time, but, you know, we don't have radar guns installed in our visors.
Right, right.
So in that fraction of a second we have to scan the ice, what are the actual physical tells? Like the honest signals we should be processing to calculate that closing speed?
Well, the human brain processes visual information rapidly, but you really have to train it to look at the correct anatomy. When scanning an incoming defender, you process 3 specific layers of information.
Okay, what's layer 1?
First, you read the hips. A defender's stick can wave wildly to deceive you. Their shoulders can drop. But the hips are biomechanically honest.
Biomechanically honest. I like that.
Yeah, because a human being can only accelerate in the direction their pelvic girdle is aligned.
So the hips dictate the future. If their hips are locked, facing the boards, they cannot suddenly accelerate up the ice to catch you.
Exactly. Second layer, you analyze their feet. You are looking for the difference between gliding and crossing over.
Gliding versus crossing over. Why is that distinction so important?
Because a gliding defender is a dangerous defender. They're in a neutral state. They can pivot, transition, or explode in any direction almost instantly.
Right.
But a defender locked into full crossovers, they have fully committed their body weight and their momentum to a specific trajectory, you can consistently beat a crossing over defender simply by attacking the space counter to their momentum.
I would assume the third signal is numerical, right? Because if I beat one guy with a brilliant read on his hips, but his defensive partner is right behind him, I mean, I've spent my currency for nothing.
Right. So how do we account for arriving players? You calculate the math of convergence. One aggressively closing opponent is a geometry problem you can solve with a physical maneuver like a delay or a cutback.
Got two?
Two opponents arriving simultaneously from intersecting angles. That is not a problem you solve with your feet. That is a problem you solve by releasing the puck. Whatever space you manage to pry open by beating the first defender will just be instantaneously occupied by the second.
So, what should we remember here? Let's pause and lock this foundational mental model into place for you, the listener. The next time you find yourself on the ice, or hey, even just analyzing a game from the stands, do not look at the static distance between the puck carrier and the defender.
Ask yourself, which way are the defender's hips pointing and what is their closing speed?
Exactly. That calculation is the true measure of your time budget.
And having redefined the currency of time as the manipulation of closing speed, we transition naturally to, well, the active pursuit of manufacturing it. We need to examine the offensive toolkit.
Right. Let's explore how we dictate the terms of engagement before the puck even arrives. The human instinct is to visually track the puck, like a predator tracking prey, right?
Yeah.
We stare at it from the moment it leaves our teammate's stick until it hits our blade.
Which is an incredibly expensive habit.
Why is it expensive?
Because the fundamental rule of offensive hockey is that information is time. Your temporal budget begins draining the absolute millisecond the puck touches your blade.
Wow.
If you spend the first half second of possession looking up to orient yourself, you have just squandered 50% of your time budget acquiring environmental data you could have obtained for free.
So we are talking about the critical habit of pre-scanning. You have to shoulder check while the puck is still in transit. But, I mean, players push back on this constantly.
They do, all the time.
There's this deep fear that if they take their eyes off the puck, it's going to hop their stick.
And that fear stems from a total misunderstanding of human vision. You do not catch a hockey puck by staring a hole through it with your foveal vision.
Foveal being the direct, sharp, central focus.
Right. You catch a pass utilizing your hands, proprioception, and your peripheral vision. By relying on your periphery to track the inbound pass, you free your primary visual focus to map the ice, locate the pressure, and identify your out.
So knowing your escape route before the puck arrives buys you infinitely more time than any highlight reel physical maneuver you could ever practice.
Exactly. Once we have the puck and we have our environmental map, we move to the psychology of space.
Deception.
Deception.
Yeah.
Because we aren't just trying to outskate people, we're trying to create space in a defender's mind before it ever manifests on the physical ice.
Right. A defender is inherently disadvantaged because they cannot cover every conceivable option simultaneously. They're forced to predict.
They have to guess.
They must commit their weight and positioning to the option they believe you are going to execute. So your primary job as a puck carrier is to vividly show them the wrong option. Let's break down the biomechanics of a classic fake shot. Because you don't just, like, wave your stick around.
No. You have to load your physical weight onto your back leg. You deliberately drop your shoulder. You initiate the backward sweeping motion of the stick.
And if you sell that kinetic chain effectively, a shot-blocking defender instinctively drops a knee. Or they widen their stance to absorb the impact. The goaltender violently sets their edges.
And in that precise fraction of a second, both the defender and the goaltender have entirely ceased their lateral movement. They are anchored to the ice.
They're stuck.
Yep. The passing lane across the Royal Road or the lane to simply step around the compromised defender is suddenly wide open.
But there is a massive psychological catch to deception, isn't there? A fake only sells if the defender truly fears the threat.
Oh, absolutely. If you're standing in the corner near the blue line, a place you have never shot from in your entire career, and you wind up for a fake slap shot, nobody's going to flinch.
Right. They're just going to look at you like you're crazy.
Deception operates on a system of credit. You only build good credit with opposing defenses by occasionally paying up and taking the lethal shot. If you are not a legitimate shooting threat, your fakes are mathematically worthless.
That is such a good way to frame it. The system of credit.
Mm-hmm.
And we can also manipulate tracking just using our head and eyes, right? Through look-off pass.
Yeah, goaltenders are trained from childhood to read the puck carrier's eye direction. It's the earliest available telemetry on where the puck is going.
So the look-off violently exploits that early tracking training. You turn your head and lock your eyes hard onto an outside passing option, but you snap the puck through the middle.
Exactly. When you look hard left, the defense leans left. However, the cost of the look-off is that you are executing a blind pass. You're no longer looking at your actual target.
Which means this tool is strictly reserved for passes you have already surveyed and confirmed during your pre-scan.
Yes. If you didn't pre-scan, the look-off is a turnover waiting to happen.
Right. Okay, I'm going to push back on this entire concept of deception for a moment.
Go for it.
This psychological manipulation sounds brilliant in a controlled environment. But what if I'm retrieving a dump-in, right? I have two aggressive forecheckers breathing down my neck, and I can literally hear their skates carving the ice behind me. I do not have the beat of time required to load my weight for a fake shot or orchestrate some elaborate look-off.
That is a vital distinction to make. Deception is a luxury good.
A luxury good.
It requires an initial investment of time to execute. In a scenario with immense pressure and zero time budget, attempting deception is catastrophic.
So what do you do?
You skip the fake entirely, you eat the puck, take the hit to make the play, or execute the simplest, safest wall rim available.
Okay, so assuming we aren't completely trapped, let's explore a tactic that completely defies human instinct, the delay and curlback.
One of my favorites.
Because when an amateur player crosses the blue line on an attack, their brain screams at them to drive the net. North-south aggression. Go, go, go.
Yeah.
But elite players routinely do the exact opposite.
Right. When you carry the puck into a contested zone and your peripheral vision registers that the primary passing options are smothered, driving the net is tactical suicide. You are simply handing the puck to the opposition.
So instead, you turn your back on the pressure.
Yes. You execute a tight, protected turn, pinning the puck to your outside hip so your physical body acts as a shield between the puck and the defender's stick, and you curl back toward the neutral zone.
And to the untrained eye, it looks like a retreat. Like, it looks like you were slowing the game down.
But you're not slowing the game down. You are synchronizing your support structure. A teammate who is one stride late crossing the blue line is structurally useless.
Right.
By holding the puck on your outside hip for 1.5 seconds, you allow that late teammate to arrive with speed, transforming a static situation into a dynamic, multi-layered attack.
Furthermore, you are preserving the most valuable real estate on the ice, the space directly behind the defending unit.
Exactly. If you attack into that space alone, you burn it for a low percentage shot. Delaying keeps that space banked.
You force the defending unit into an excruciating dilemma. Like, do they step up to aggressively pressure your delay and thereby abandon that critical space behind them? Or do they passively fall back, essentially gifting you a clean zone entry and an uncontested shot from the high slot?
Exactly. It's a lose-lose for the defense. But there is a non-negotiable warning label attached to the delay tactic.
Oh, I can guess.
You never, under any circumstances, execute a curlback in your own defensive zone when under pressure.
Never.
If you delay near your own net, slip an edge, or get pickpocketed, it results in an immediate, unrecoverable grade A scoring chance against. The delay is strictly a tool for the offensive zone and neutral zone transitions.
Okay, let's shift from manipulating positioning to manipulating rhythm. Changing pace.
Yeah.
In a straight line, two players racing for a puck looks like a test of pure speed. But separation from a defender rarely comes from hitting your maximum miles per hour, does it?
No, not at all. Separation is generated by manipulating the speed differential.
Speed differential.
Right. If you and a defender are both skating at your absolute maximum velocity, the physical distance between you remains static. You will never separate.
Because you're just matching each other stride for stride.
Exactly. Furthermore, if you skate at one constant punishing speed for your entire shift, you become incredibly easy to defend because your rhythm is entirely predictable.
Hmm.
The defender simply calibrates their stride to match yours.
So the formula for explosive separation is actually glide, look, and explode.
Yes. Deceleration becomes an offensive weapon.
Walk us through that sequence.
When you suddenly drop into a glide, you force the tracking defender to guess. Do they maintain their aggressive gap and risk you blowing past them if they misjudge it? Or do they ease off their edges and grant you an extra foot of space?
And while their brain is processing that decision,
you're using the physical stability of the glide to scan the ice. The exact millisecond the defender adjusts their velocity to match your glide, they are biomechanically vulnerable. That is when you explode with three hard crossovers.
Two sharp crossovers, executing out of a glide, generate vastly more functional separation than 10 strides of constant, predictable maximum effort.
It's all about the burst. And this pace manipulation is equally devastating without the puck.
How so?
Think about a forward who deliberately drifts into a soft area of the ice, lulling their defending check into this relaxed, flat-footed posture,
right,
and then suddenly detonates into open space. That player is infinitely more difficult to cover than a guy aimlessly sprinting around the zone, exhausting themselves.
Right. We just touched on breaking into open space, which leads us perfectly to attacking the defense's structure. What is the most ubiquitous mistake an attacking player makes when leading a rush against a set defense?
Skating directly at the chest of a defender.
Why is that so bad?
Because when you map your route directly at an opponent, you are gifting them a stationary problem. You make their defensive assignment incredibly simple because they can solve it just by standing their ground and maintaining their gap.
So to manufacture space, we don't attack the man. We attack the ambiguity between the men. We attack the seam.
Yes. The seam is the unclaimed, highly contested corridor of ice situated exactly between two defenders. When you drive your route directly into that seam, you force the defense to make a split-second, high-stakes decision.
Like who cakes him?
Exactly. Who assumes responsibility for the puck carrier? They are forced to communicate flawlessly while skating backward at 20 miles an hour.
And communication under severe time constraints inevitably breeds chaos.
Always. If both defensemen panic and pinch to take you, you just manufactured a wide-open two-on-one for your trailing forwards.
And if neither defenseman steps up, because they each assumed the other had containment.
Yeah.
You split them for a breakaway.
Brilliant. Okay, to recap the offensive manufacturing process for you guys listening. We utilize pre-scanning to buy time before the reception. We deploy deception to freeze defenders and create mental space. We utilize delays to synchronize our support and protect high-value real estate. We manipulate pace with the glide-look-explode sequence to create speed differentials. And we attack the seams to force communication breakdowns.
Every single one of those tactics is engineered to manipulate either the physical distance or the closing speed of the opponent.
Exactly. So we have spent considerable time building up a robust bank account of time and space. Now, we flip the script.
Now we become the repo men.
The repo men, I love it. We are moving into the defensive toolkit. If offense is the art of manufacturing time, defense is the brutal, systematic business of bankrupting your opponent's time budget.
And we initiate the bankruptcy process with gap control. We established earlier that the gap is the physical distance between the defender and the puck carrier.
Right.
Managing that gap is the most significant tactical lever a defender possesses. But gap control is governed by an unforgiving law of trade-offs. There is no perfect gap.
Okay, let's look at the trade-offs. If I'm a defenseman in the neutral zone, and I decide to play a suffocatingly tight gap, say, one stick length away from the attacker's chest, I completely erase their time budget, right?
Mm.
They can't scan the ice, they can't set up a deceptive move, but I am exposing a massive vulnerability, aren't I?
You are surrendering your back. By playing tight, you invite the attacker to chip the puck into the vast expanse of ice behind you and engage in a pure foot race.
And if I lose that foot race, it's a breakaway.
Exactly. Conversely, if you play a loose, conservative gap, giving them three or four stick lengths, well, you protect the ice behind you. You eliminate the foot race.
But I hand the attacker a terrifying advantage.
Huge advantage. A loose gap gifts the attacker a pristine head-up survey of the entire offensive zone. You give them the runway to build maximum velocity, and you allow them to cross the blue line with total control.
You protect your back, but you bleed defensive zone time.
Right. The decision of whether to play tight or loose hinges entirely on your ability to read the honest signals we discussed earlier, specifically the attacker's hips and their momentum.
Okay, so once we have established our gap, we have to steer the threat. Let's talk about angling. It is crucial to understand that angling is a function of pure geometry, not foot speed.
Yes. Angling is the systematic removal of options through pursuit routes. You are not chasing the puck carrier from behind in a direct line.
What are you doing instead?
You are calculating their trajectory and plotting an intersecting curve that actively denies them access to the middle of the ice. You steer them until their only remaining geographical option is the physical boards.
You suffocate their space without ever having to win a straight line foot race.
Exactly. And seamlessly paired with angling is a concept the coaching guide identifies as the highest return on effort action in defensive hockey. The active stick.
The active stick. It requires zero cardiovascular exertion, yet it pays immense tactical dividends.
An active stick dictates that the blade of your stick is flat on the ice, actively protruding into a passing lane or directly threatening the puck carrier's intended route. It is often the first fundamental habit that exhausted players abandon.
Let me play devil's advocate here. As a defender, doesn't it make more sense to wait for the attacker to initiate their pass or their deke and then aggressively jab or stick lift them at the exact moment of execution? It feels more disruptive.
Jabbing is a high-risk gamble. If you attempt to disrupt a pass mid-execution and you miss the puck, which, you know, happens frequently given the speed of the game, the momentum of your missed jab pulls your entire upper body out of structural position.
And the attacker effortlessly bypasses you.
Right. But the active stick prevents the action from ever initiating.
How?
When a defender places their blade flat on the ice in a passing lane before the attacker even initiates the pass, you alter the attacker's decision-making matrix. The puck carrier scans the zone, sees the blade blocking the lane at ankle height, and is forced to recalculate their entire sequence.
You've stolen their time without committing your body weight.
And the detail regarding ankle height is paramount. A stick waving through the air at hip height is useless. Passes travel on the ice.
Prevent the thought. Don't just react to the action. This leads us to one of the most brilliant, counterintuitive insights in the entire strategy guide. Denying the reception. When most defenders see a pass fired across the ice, their instinct is to lunge and intercept it in open water.
And passes at the elite level travel too fast for consistent mid-ice interception. When you lunge for a puck in transit, you are essentially guessing the trajectory. If your guess is off by an inch, you are entirely removed from the defensive structure, and the opposing team has a numerical advantage.
So the alternative is a masterclass in exploiting human biology. Instead of attacking the pass, you attack the reception. You mapped a route that ensures your physical body and your stick arrive on the intended receiver at the exact millisecond the puck impacts their blade.
Yes, why is this so devastating? Because human beings possess limited cognitive bandwidth. If you apply heavy physical pressure at the exact moment of reception, the receiver is forced to allocate 100% of their cognitive and visual focus simply to corralling the puck.
They must look down.
Exactly. You have entirely destroyed their ability to pre-scan. You have forced them into a state of temporary blindness. Even if the pass successfully reaches them, they have zero situational awareness.
You bankrupt their time without ever having to touch the puck yourself.
Incredible. We've covered individual defensive tactics. Now we must address structural defense, pressure and layering. Why is it a systemic disaster to have one exceptionally aggressive forward hunt the puck solo?
Lone pressure is a fallacy. It does not compress space. It merely relocates it. If you send a single forechecker F1 sprinting into the zone to pressure a poised puck carrier, and F1 has no structural support, they have just vacated a massive quadrant of ice behind them.
Right.
If the puck carrier executes a simple wall pass or sidesteps the pressure, that vacated ice becomes a high-speed corridor for the counterattack. Your team is immediately caught in a transition playing a man down.
So pressure is only functional when it operates as an integrated system. Layering. Think of the standard 2-1-2 forecheck structure. The F1 forward applies the initial disruptive pressure. But that pressure only terrifies the defense because the F2 forward is layered meticulously behind and slightly offset.
Perfectly positioned to intercept the panic pass or to physically engage if F1 gets beaten.
Rogue, unlayered pressure is not defense, it is sabotage.
And when defending space, we have to recognize that not all real estate holds equal value. Defending the middle.
If you are defensively compromised and forced to concede territory to an attacker, you universally concede the outside perimeter. You steer them into the boards.
Because the middle of the ice,
yeah,
the high slot, is the most lethal real estate in the rink.
It offers the most radiating options. A puck carrier in the slot can distribute left, right, or release a high-danger shot. The analytics are undeniable. Shots originating from the middle of the ice convert at an exponentially higher rate than shots from the perimeter.
Choke the middle, defend the inside shoulder, and allow the wide, low-percentage shot.
Right. And, you know, we have spent significant time discussing how human beings manipulate space with their bodies and their cognitive decisions, but we must now transition to the invisible architecture of the game itself.
Section 4. How the literal physical rink and the rigid ink of the rulebook actively manufacture and constrain space. Let's start with the physical map. We need to assign real estate values to the ice surface. Where does the most valuable space live?
The absolute safest, most high-value real estate on the ice is directly behind the opponent's net.
Behind the net.
Yeah, it acts as an impenetrable bunker. You can only be physically attacked from two specific angles. You possess a panoramic view of the entire offensive zone. And structurally, any defender who commits to chasing you around one side of the net entirely surrenders the opposite side.
It's the ultimate offensive pivot point. Wayne Gretzky didn't set up his office there by accident.
Not at all. Next on the map is the weak side.
The vertical half of the ice opposite to where the puck currently resides.
Right. Defensive systems are universally trained to slide, compress, and collapse heavily toward the puck to establish numerical superiority. Consequently, the far side of the ice is perpetually underdefended.
This structural reality is why cross-ice east-west passes are so devastatingly effective. The pass literally travels faster than the defense's ability to structurally slide and recover.
Exactly. Other high space zones include the point up high by the blue line, which is inherently defended less because it is the furthest geographical point from the net and the half wall.
The area on the boards level with the face-off circles.
The half wall is tactically brilliant. The physical boards protect one flank, the deep corner secures your back, and you have pristine sight lines into the slot. Furthermore, it is structurally agonizing for a defender to aggressively pressure a player on the half wall, as doing so requires them to abandon their central defensive posture.
So if those are the high-rent districts, where does space go to die? Where are the low-space zones?
The slot. The ice directly between the face-off circles in front of the net. Every single defensive system on Earth is obsessively designed to pack bodies, sticks, and shin pads into the slot.
It's the most valuable scoring area, but it offers zero time budget.
If you receive the puck in the slot, you do not dust it off. You do not stick handle. You execute a one-touch shot, a deflection, or you get crushed.
So the overarching architectural rule, when you possess the puck, navigate towards space. the weak side, the point behind the net. When you do not possess the puck, navigate your body toward where the space will inevitably materialize. This brings us to a fascinating conceptual pivot, how the rulebook itself creates space.
Most players view the rulebook as a tedious list of prohibitions. In reality, it is a topographical map. The rules generate invisible, rigid geographic boundaries that intelligent players endlessly exploit.
Let's dissect offside. The fundamental intent of the rule is to prevent cherry picking, right?
Right.
You can't cross the offensive blue line before the puck. But the granular nuances of the offside rule dictate exactly how much physical space you can command at the blue line.
Consider a player receiving a pass at the blue line. Amateurs typically hit the brakes aggressively, stopping entirely before the line to ensure they remain onside.
And in doing so, they surrender several feet of prime attacking real estate.
The elite mechanic is to stretch the body into the zone while dragging a trailing skate on the line.
And this is where the rulebook variations become critical. In the NHL and international IIHF play, a player is legally onside, even if their trailing skate is hovering in the air above the blue line, breaking the vertical plane.
But if you attempt that exact physical mechanic in a USA Hockey or Hockey Canada sanctioned game, the whistle blows. Under those rulebooks, the trailing skate must maintain physical, tactile contact with the ice surface. A hovering skate is an offside skate.
So you have to know what league you're in. Let's look at delayed offsides. This is where the rulebook actually stunts cognitive development, depending on where you play.
Oh, absolutely. A delayed offside occurs when an attacking player enters the zone early, the linesman signals the infraction, but the play is not immediately whistled dead. The attacking team is granted a window to exit the zone, to tag up at the blue line, clearing the infraction dynamically without halting the flow of the game.
It preserves momentum and recoverable space.
However, under USA Hockey regulations, this delayed offside grace period does not exist for younger age brackets, specifically below the youth 15 only level. The whistle is instantaneous,
which fundamentally alters spatial development.
Right. If you're coaching U14 players in the United States and attempting to teach them the complex spatial awareness required to quickly tag up and re-engage, you are teaching a concept the rule book forbids. They do not develop the cognitive habit of spatial resetting.
Wow, that's wild.
And even when delayed offside is permitted, the triggers for a whistle vary wildly. In the NHL, if an offside player even feints aggressive contact toward the defending puck carrier during the delay, the whistle blows. USA Hockey lacks that specific about-to-make-contact provision, allowing for far more aggressive positional posturing during the tag-up phase.
The rule book dictates the parameters of your aggression. Now, let's analyze icing, the rule designed to prevent a panicked team from endlessly launching the puck down the ice.
Modern hockey employs hybrid icing. It initiates a foot race for the puck, but utilizing the end zone faceoff dot as a strict decision deadline.
The linesman evaluates the relative velocities of the racing players and determines who will arrive first at the exact instant the lead player crosses that dot. If it is ambiguous, they blow it dead for icing to prevent high-speed collisions into the end boards.
The penalty for an icing infraction is where space becomes deeply weaponized. It is known as the trap.
The trap.
In the NHL and IIHF, if you ice the puck, the ensuing faceoff is dragged all the way back deep into your defensive zone. But the true punishment is physiological. The offending team is strictly prohibited from executing a line change, and they are barred from utilizing their timeout.
You trap five rapidly exhausting players on the ice, forcing them to defend a critical defensive zone faceoff against a unit of fully rested attackers. It is a suffocating compression of their time budget.
But once again, we encounter massive rulebook disparities.
Right, because USA Hockey does not enforce the line change prohibition or the timeout ban on icing infractions.
Exactly. If you ice the puck in a USA Hockey game, you are freely permitted to change your exhausted personnel. Hockey Canada only enforces the line change ban at elite amateur tiers like junior and U18 AAA, and even then, they permit the use of a timeout to secure rest.
So the devastating tactical reality of the trap in professional hockey simply does not exist in most recreational or amateur rulebooks.
It's completely different.
Let's discuss the goaltender's architectural constraints. The trapezoid.
The trapezoid. It's the specifically painted geometric area behind the net, implemented to prevent highly athletic goaltenders from operating as a third defenseman. Under NHL and IIHF rules, if a goaltender plays the puck behind the goal line, outside the physical boundaries of that painted trapezoid, they are assessed a delay of game penalty.
So how does an attacking team exploit this painted geometry?
By executing precision dump-ins, You deliberately fire the puck deep into the corner, purposefully wide of the trapezoid. Because the goaltender is legally paralyzed and cannot retrieve it, an opposing defenseman is forced to turn their back to the play, sprint into the corner, and absorb the physical impact of your arriving forechecker.
Use the paint on the ice to force a physical confrontation.
But the paint doesn't exist everywhere.
Right. USA Hockey and Hockey Canada do not paint a trapezoid. The concept doesn't exist in their rulebooks.
However, they maintain alternative constraints. Under those frameworks, a goaltender receives a penalty if they freeze the puck against the boards behind the goal line while their body is entirely outside the crease. They are permitted to play a dumped puck in the corner, but they are forbidden from smothering it to force a stoppage.
Let's move to the physical battles for space, the crease and picks. Every so often in a beer league game, you see a player attempt a basketball-style pick, trying to run interference to open up a skating lane for a teammate.
It is entirely illegal. There are zero provisions for illegal picks in the sport of ice hockey.
Zero.
If you maneuver your body into an opponent's established skating lane without having already established prior body position purely to obstruct their path to the puck or a teammate, that is textbook interference, and the consequences are severe. Depending on the violence of the obstruction, rulebooks allow for major penalties or game misconducts.
Because the underlying legal test is movement. You possess an absolute right to the specific patch of ice you are occupying. You do not possess the right to proactively skate into someone else's lane to block them.
There is, however, one glaring tactical exception where you are actively encouraged to block an opponent's path.
The goaltender.
Yes. You are legally permitted and tactically expected to screen the goaltender. Establishing a visual screen occupying the goaltender's line of sight without initiating physical contact is entirely legal, with one massive geographical caveat.
You must remain outside the painted blue goal crease.
The moment you step a millimeter inside that blue paint, you enter a labyrinth of rule book interpretations.
Walk us through it.
The crease is sacred geometry designed to protect the goaltender's physical safety. In the NHL, a goal is disallowed if an attacking player's presence inside the crease demonstrably impairs the goaltender's ability to move or play their position. It is a judgment call based on impairment.
USA Hockey removes the judgment entirely. They apply a draconian positional standard.
Right. If an attacking player has any part of their body or equipment inside the crease and a goal is scored, it is instantaneously disallowed. It does not matter who shot the puck or if the goalie was impeded.
Unless there is a specific sequence of events.
The narrow exceptions are if the puck physically enters the crease volume before the attacking player does, or if the goaltender has completely vacated the crease area. But even that exception is a trapdoor.
How so?
If the goaltender is outside the crease but desperately scrambling to return, and you are standing in the paint blocking their recovery path, the goal is waved off, and you are penalized for interference.
And the most absurd detail of the USA Hockey rule, it specifies attacking player, which includes equipment.
Oh, this one hurts.
If your teammate rips a shot from the point and you extend your stick blade into the blue paint, attempting a deflection, and the puck goes in, the referee is mandated to wave off the goal simply because the composite carbon of your stick blade broke the vertical plane of the crease.
A tipped stick costs you the goal.
Hockey Canada takes a slightly different approach, correct?
Hockey Canada is marginally more permissive. They will allow a goal to stand with an attacker in the crease, provided that the attacker remains entirely passive. They cannot attempt to play the puck, they cannot initiate contact, and crucially, they cannot establish a visual screen from inside the paint.
So you can stand in the Canadian crease like a statue and possibly survive a video review, but if the official determines you obstructed the goaltender's vision, the goal is erased.
The overarching lesson for the listener regarding the rules. You must know exactly which rulebook governs your specific game, because the painted lines and the ink in the book literally dictate where the invisible space lives and dies.
This transitions us to our final major analytical section, Section 5, Environmental Distortions, Context and Development. Space is not a static entity. It breathes, expands, and contracts based on the fluid environment of the game.
The most profound environmental distortion is the score. The numbers on the scoreboard radically dictate the geographic distribution of space.
If a team is protecting a one-goal lead late in the third period, they fundamentally alter their defensive architecture.
A leading team will deliberately and strategically concede the low-value peripheral space to violently protect the high-value central space. They will retract into a passive 1-2-2 trap.
They'll just let you have the boards.
They will gleefully allow you possession along the boards, and they will allow your defenseman unpressured possession at the red line. But they will entirely choke the middle of the ice. They will pack five bodies into the slot and force you to navigate a dense forest of sticks.
So what's the offensive counter strategy to this distortion?
You must take the space they are willingly offering. The worst possible decision against a trapping leading team is to heroically force passes through the congested middle.
Because that plays directly into their architecture, resulting in turnovers and odd man rushes the other way.
Exactly. You must utilize the point, aggressively cycle the puck below the goal line, and execute low to high passes. You drag their rigid structure out of alignment rather than attempting to brute force a pass through a brick wall.
The clock is another massive spatial distortion.
Radically so. When a desperate team pulls their goaltender for an extra attacker in the final minutes, they create a literal 6-on-5 numerical advantage. This creates massive, undefendable pockets of space, particularly high in the offensive zone.
Conversely, the defending team is hyper-aware that the opposing net is empty, which transforms any blind clearing attempt from a panicked icing into a potential game-sealing goal. But the clock also introduces the ultimate physiological variable, fatigue.
And fatigue completely rewires our foundational equation of time.
Remind us again.
Time equals distance divided by closing speed. When we defined that, we assumed fresh legs. In the final 30 seconds of a grueling shift, lactic acid saturates the muscles. A defender simply cannot generate the explosive closing speed they possessed at the start of the period.
Because their maximum closing speed drops significantly, their effective gap becomes much larger than their physical gap.
Suddenly, everyone on the ice possesses a larger time budget simply because the physical capacity for violence has degraded.
Let's discuss the literal physical environment, rink size. The dimensions of the ice sheet completely alter the geometry of the sport.
The standard North American NHL rink measures 200 feet in length by 85 feet in width. The traditional International Olympic sheet maintains roughly the same length, but expands to approximately 98 feet in width.
An extra 13 feet of width might not sound like a paradigm shift to a casual fan, but it completely rewires the tactical reality of the game.
It alters the geometry of pursuit. On the wider international ice, the distance from the sideboards to the middle slot is significantly longer. If an aggressive forechecker commits to finishing a check on a defenseman along the wall, it takes them considerably longer to recover their positioning back to the center of the ice.
Therefore, wide ice heavily rewards east-west puck movement, prolonged delay tactics, and possession-based patience.
Whereas the narrow NHL ice demands a completely different cognitive processing speed. On narrow ice, space is violently compressed. The walls are always dangerously close. Forecheckers arrive instantaneously.
Narrow ice demands lightning fast, north-south decision-making, and heavily rewards physical disruption.
And it is worth noting a recent historical shift. Olympic ice does not automatically mean wide ice anymore. The 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics were contested on the narrower NHL dimensions.
The international governing bodies are increasingly embracing the compressed, high-action reality of the smaller rink.
So the practical application for you listening, playing in a local rec league, know your barn, skate a warm-up lap, visually measure the distance from the face-off dot to the boards. That physical measurement dictates your cognitive time budget for the entire evening.
Having analyzed these environments, the critical question becomes, how do we actively develop the cognitive processing speed required to master this time and space? How do we build hockey IQ?
The gold standard for development, universally agreed upon by elite coaches, is small area games.
Cross-ice scrimmages, 3-on-3 battles confined to a single end zone.
By artificially shrinking the physical space, you enforce sensory overload. You force players to accumulate more touches on the puck, execute more complex decisions per touch, and process the chaos with significantly reduced time budgets.
It's the neurological equivalent of a baseball player swinging a weighted bat in the on-deck circle.
When you transition from a claustrophobic small area game back to a full 200-foot sheet of ice, the spatial reality feels incredibly fast. Your brain's decision-making speed has been permanently upgraded through the crucible of constraint.
How does this apply to how we spectate the game? How can a fan train their brain to see this invisible architecture?
This is a challenge for every listener. The next time you watch a high-level hockey game, force yourself to not watch the puck.
No, watch the puck.
The puck is merely a piece of vulcanized rubber. It tells you nothing about the structure of the play. Pick one single elite player and track only them for an entire 45-second shift. Watch what they are doing during the 35 seconds that you not have the puck.
You will see the constant obsessive pre-scanning.
You will observe them checking their shoulder three times before the breakout pass even initiates. You will see them deliberately execute a two-second glide to manipulate a tracking defender's velocity.
You will suddenly realize that what television commentators label as highlight reel skill is actually just the inevitable byproduct of a player arriving in pristine open ice because they mapped and manipulated the space vastly better than anyone else.
Which brings us to the ultimate question, the most vital diagnostic question a player can ask themselves after jumping over the boards at the end of a shift.
You sit on the bench, you regulate your breathing, and you ask yourself objectively, did I have more time than I thought I did?
And the honest answer is almost universally yes. Inexperienced or overwhelmed players operate in a default cognitive state of panic.
Panic is a thief.
It forces you to spend the temporal currency you actually had safely in the bank. Every rushed pass through the middle, every blind backhand flip out of the defensive zone, those are micro moments where the objective answer was, yes, I had considerably more time than my brain allowed me to believe.
So the correction isn't simply a coach yelling, be braver. The correction is mechanical and actionable.
Exactly. The correction is demanding one additional look over your shoulder before the pass arrives. If you genuinely do not know what is behind you, the correction is to turn your body away from the pressure rather than blindly passing into it.
The correction is trusting the auditory cues of your teammates. If your goaltender, who possesses the only unobscured sight lines on the ice, yells time, you must override your panic and believe them.
This has been an absolutely phenomenal masterclass. Let's move to our outro and construct the final mental model for our listeners. Let's synthesize everything we have unpacked today about the true currency of the game.
The comprehensive framework is this. Physical skill, your hands, your shot, is entirely useless without the time to execute it. Time is not measured by a ticking clock. It is dictated strictly by the closing speed of your opponent.
You actively manipulate that closing speed by utilizing deception to induce mental hesitation, by altering your skating pace to create velocity differentials, and by weaponizing the literal geometry of the rulebook and the rink architecture.
Let's lock this in for you, the listener. We want you to retain this permanently. This is our If You Only Remember 10 Things summary. I'll take the odds, you take the evens. Number one, time is distance divided by closing speed. Stop looking at how far away the defender is. Read their hips and their crossovers to calculate their true acceleration.
Number two, deception and pace changes manufacture mental space before physical space. A biomechanically convincing fake shot anchors a defender to the ice. Gliding before exploding shatters their tracking rhythm.
Number three, scan before the puck arrives. Your temporal budget begins draining the millisecond the puck touches your blade. Purchase your environmental information while the pass is still in transit.
Number four, attack the seams between defenders. Never skate directly at a static opponent's chest. Drive into the ambiguous space between two defenders to force communication breakdowns and structural chaos.
Number five, utilize the net and the boards to protect your vulnerable flanks. The real estate directly behind the opponent's net is the safest, most structurally advantageous pivot point on the entire ice surface.
Number six, on defense, steer the threat with your pursuit route. Deploy angling geometry to systematically remove the middle of the ice and force the attacker into the confined space of the outside wall.
Number seven, deploy an active stick and actively deny the reception. Do not lunge at mid-ice passes. Arrive with the puck to force the receiver to catch it under extreme physical pressure, destroying their ability to pre-scan.
Number eight, the rulebook is a spatial topography map. You must know exactly how your specific league governs delayed offsides, the trapezoid constraints, and the blue paint of the crease. The rules literally dictate where the invisible space lives.
Number nine, high-value space lives on the weak side, and behind the net, space goes to die in the high slot. Never attempt to casually stick handle in the middle of the ice.
And number 10, always ask yourself, did I have more time than I thought? Unchecked panic spends the currency you fought so incredibly hard to earn.
Incredible. We started this deep dive talking about that highlight reel goal. We discussed how easy it is to be mesmerized by the spectacular finish, the toe drag, the blistering shot, and mistakenly believe that is the entire story. It is like pointing at the jagged line on an EKG and ignoring the heart underneath.
The true reality of elite performance is the murky, invisible, cognitive work executed 3 seconds prior to the highlight, the pre-scan, the subtle one-second glide that froze the tracking offender, the meticulous calculation and exploitation of the opponent's closing speed.
I want to leave you, the listener, with a final provocative thought that takes this entire mental model far beyond the confines of a hockey rink. Think about your own profession. Think about your daily operational life. Where in your career are you skating at absolute maximum velocity, burning massive amounts of cognitive energy, but gaining absolutely no separation from the pack because your rhythm is entirely predictable? Where are you staring obsessively at the puck, the immediate glowing task right in front of your face, instead of utilizing your peripheral vision to scan the ice before the real problem even arrives on your desk? How can you consciously incorporate a glide, a look, and an explosion into your own daily decisions to earn yourself just a little bit more time and space? Something to think about. Until next time.